Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth.
Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchuk. On today's show, we'll hear excerpts of a presentation and discussion about the U.S. digital television transition held at the Flow TV conference in Austin, Texas in October 2008. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, here are two selections of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. While most Americans were focused on the presidential elections on November 4th, there was another historic vote happening at the Federal Communications Commission. The commission voted to open unused portions of the television spectrum, known as white spaces, for public use and unlicensed devices. The powerful National Association of Broadcasters tried to stop the vote by rounding up Broadway theater producers, sports franchises, and entertainers like Dolly Parton to put pressure on the FCC. But a strong coalition of the nation's leading consumer, media, and public interest groups, along with technology giants Google and Microsoft, urged the commission to heed the scientific evidence that white space devices would not interfere with TV programming or other live events. The FCC expressed confidence in those findings. Commissioner Michael Copps said the agency has to balance usage with innovation.
When setting responsible spectrum policy, the FCC must always recognize that technology cannot stand still, and that even as we protect existing users from harmful interference, we also have an obligation to promote innovation, because until someone finds a way to make more electromagnetic spectrum, it is only innovation that can improve the wireless choices available to consumers.
Chairman Kevin Martin outlined the kinds of devices that consumers can expect to see in the future that will make use of the white space spectrum.
Consumers across the country will have access to devices and services that they may have only dreamed about before. I expect that everything from enhanced home broadband networks to intelligent peer-to-peer devices and even small communications networks will come into being in this TV white spaces.
Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein sees white spaces as one of the keys to getting the country back to economic health.
White spaces are the blank pages on which we'll write our broadband future. This is a consequential decision because our country's future depends on wireless broadband to improve our economy, our quality of life, even in the most remote and rural areas of the country. Let's hope it's not just Wi-Fi and steroids, but Wi-Fi on amphetamines as well, because it'll be that fast.
For more information on white spaces, go to freepress.net/white spaces.
As Americans were lining up at the polls, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the broadcast indecency case of FCC versus Fox. The FCC is hoping the court will reverse a lower court's decision that the agency wrongly cracked down on Fox 4 years ago after Cher and Nicole Richie used expletives on live broadcasts of award shows. Fox had successfully argued that the agency sought to sanction broadcasters without sufficient notice or explanation. Cheryl Lianza, an attorney and policy director for the media justice arm of the United Church of Christ, says this particular case focuses on Fox, but it has implications for all broadcasters.
The FCC decided when it reviewed Fox's broadcast that it was going to fine broadcasters if they had indecent fleeting expletives. So even one or two swear words as opposed to repeated use of swear words would be potentially subject to a fine.
If the Supreme Court rules in favor of the FCC, more broadcasters could face steep fines.
The reason that this is important is that the new rules will apply not only to the big broadcasters like Fox when they're putting on the Golden Globes on national primetime network television, but these rules also apply to the tiniest, smallest, non-commercial radio broadcaster in the country as well. So everybody needs to be much more careful that nobody swears on the air by mistake, because they could get a very significant fine. The fines are, you know, starting at something like $300,000, which is very significant if you're talking about the budget of a small non-commercial radio station.
Lianza says the UCC and other public interest groups are also concerned that the court could use this case to overturn the longstanding doctrine that the FCC can regulate broadcasters to be accountable to the communities they serve.
Even though this case is about indecency, all of the other public interest obligations, all the obligations to have a public file, to serve the public, to cover issues of public importance, to have limits on the size of media companies, all of those other limitations could have been in jeopardy if the Supreme Court decided to go down that road. So our biggest concern was to preserve the current state of the law so that all these obligations that we do have now would continue to remain in full force.
The Supreme Court will make its decision on the case in the next few months. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net. Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Somewhat lost amidst all the news of the presidential election was a major decision that will have a significant impact on the wireless industry. The Federal Communications Commission approved the $28 billion sale of rural wireless provider Altel to Verizon Wireless. The deal gives Verizon the most subscribers of any U.S. carrier. Joel Kelsey, policy analyst for Consumers Union, says many in the public interest community and on Capitol Hill raised serious questions about what the merger would mean for rural consumers.
In this era of financial turmoil, the FCC was very quick to put this on kind of the rocket docket and make sure that it happened. We believe that, you know, although there's financial uncertainty in the market, you really need to weigh consumers' rights when you're looking at mergers like this. And the fact that we're about to go from 5 to 4 wireless carriers in the nation is something that's alarming.
One of the greatest fears about the merger concerns roaming, the ability to use your wireless service when traveling outside the coverage area of your home network. Altel provided their small rural competitors with good roaming service. Verizon doesn't have that same track record when it comes to allowing roaming to potential competitors.
If they start canceling their roaming contracts and don't allow the other rural, smaller wireless carriers to deal with them or carry service over their network, what used to be Altel's network and is now Verizon's network, then those folks could be in a very difficult place and have to go out of business and shut its doors to some of its subscribers. And that means that they have even less choice in the marketplace.
One of the conditions of the merger is that Verizon must honor Altel's voice roaming deals for 4 years. But the commission did not make the same demand for data roaming.
In this age, when many consumers are looking to wireless to provide data connections, it seems like their options are going to be limited to Verizon and AT&T and some of the other very big wireless carriers. And some of these smaller rural carriers just won't be able to play in the game.
Another condition of the merger is forcing Verizon Altel to divest some of the spectrum they own in several markets. Those airwaves could likely be gobbled up by AT&T.
So now you have Verizon, the number 2 mobile carrier in America, merging with the number 5 to become the largest wireless carrier in the United States. And then the current number 1, soon to be number 2, AT&T, gobbling up all the leftovers. So it just seems that these companies are getting bigger and bigger, and consumers are faced with less and less choices.
When the Federal Communications Commission opened the door for more media consolidation in 2007, one of the main supporting arguments came from the National Association of Broadcasters. The NAB said that the public was turning to the internet as a supplement and replacement to traditional television. But a new Nielsen study shows that the broadcasters had it wrong. It turns out consumers aren't using the web as a substitute to traditional TV watching, but as a complement. In fact, the study found that those who use the internet the most actually watch even more TV than those who do not use the internet. Free Press policy coordinator Adam Lin says that Nielsen's media research clearly shows that people are still receiving most of their news from traditional sources like TV and newspapers.
people who used the most internet of any of the people they studied also watched the most television. And so we haven't come to a point where the internet's serving as a replacement for the overwhelming majority of people over television in any entertainment as well as news. I mean, people are diversifying the sources they get for information, but they're not replacing one with another. They're just adding.
Lynn says the Nielsen findings align with a Free Press study done last year that was filed with the FCC.
We showed that at most, someone who uses the internet for an hour reduces their viewing of local news over television by about 90 seconds.
Big media companies have long painted a picture of hyper-competition in the market and say they need to take advantage of the synergy that is produced by consolidating media businesses like newspaper and television and radio stations.
If you allow two companies who are central to gathering news in a local place combined, the first thing they're going to do is the synergies they talk about are firing journalists and making one journalist cover what used to be two journalists' job, and then you get one less viewpoint coming out. The primary goal is to extract as much revenue from that media market as possible and to do as little as possible to get that maximum amount of revenue, which is not what we can have when it comes to providing citizens with information.
For more information about media consolidation, go to stopbigmedia.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
President-elect Barack Obama says he'll put the interests of Main Street above those of Wall Street in tackling the economic crisis. It is appropriate that we ask, which Main Street is he talking about? It has been a very long time since the Main Streets of Black America were assigned any priority in terms of unemployment relief. Clearly, the criteria for government intervention in the economy is color-coded rather than based on objective measurements of social and economic distress. On Black Main Streets, for at least two generations, unemployment has consistently registered at least twice as high as on white Main Streets. The 2-to-1 racial ratio holds true in good times and in bad, as if it were a law of modern American economic life. Therefore, by any comparative analysis, African Americans are always in a state of employment crisis. Yet, Black unemployment levels are almost never considered to be intolerable, that is, a problem of such magnitude it demands fixing. The one exception, the period in which Black unemployment, especially Black youth unemployment, rated a national priority, was during the 60s, when cities burned. The unfolding economic collapse promises to disproportionately harm those who are already most damaged by racial employment structures in the United States. Officially, Black joblessness in October stood at 11.1%, compared to 5.9% for whites, 8.8% for Hispanics, and less than 4% for Asians. But it has long been apparent that the federal government's methods for counting the unemployed vastly underestimate joblessness, especially in Black America. In 2003, during the last recession, a survey that measured the employment-population ratio showed that only slightly more than half of Black males between the ages of 16 and 65 in New York City held jobs, although the official Black unemployment rate was just under 13%. The difference between 13% and 49% of Black males being outside the official labor force is the difference between a community that is gravely challenged by joblessness and one that has been crushed by it. Measuring the percentage of people who are inside or outside the official labor force provides a much better picture of that community's actual relationship to the larger economy and society. It shows us where the real structural problems are, the places where extended unemployment benefits make only marginal differences because large proportions of people have not been working on the books for a very long time or have never had an effective chance to enter the official workforce. Economic downturns are especially damaging to the employment prospects of black youth, who then wind up in the million-strong African-American prison gulag, a cohort that is not counted among the officially unemployed. These young men, and increasing numbers of young women, join the ranks of the permanently marginalized, who literally do not count in public policy discussions outside the arena of criminal justice or other projects of repression or removal. A public policy that systematically papers over the actual employment patterns of the inner city cannot even begin to tackle unemployment on black Main Street. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature excerpts of a presentation and discussion about the U.S. digital television transition held at the Flow TV conference in Austin, Texas, on Saturday, October 11, 2008. In this first excerpt, Afshin Nomai, one of the panel's moderators, introduces the panel by reading the starting question for the panel, followed by a presentation that I gave.
All right, let me go ahead and read the question so we're all familiar with where we're starting from. In February 2009, analog television broadcasting will cease and be replaced entirely by a digital signal. This issue has received little mainstream coverage, particularly in terms of what citizens will need to do to adapt to this change. What opportunities could result from the conversion to help the public and further their awareness of critical media issues? Is this a way to promote wider media literacy? What should concerned citizens and scholars do to position themselves to take advantage of these opportunities?
Okay. Well, I should actually amend the statement slightly. Not all analog television broadcasting in the United States will cease on February 17, 2009. It will be the high-power broadcast signals. Low-power signals have in recent months have received a kind of extension from the FCC to broadcast for at least the next 3 years. So this is actually, strictly speaking, a not wholly accurate statement, but nonetheless, a clarification that should be mentioned. But nonetheless, what will happen in about 5 months' time is very real. And so what I will do is I have released a position paper, which I've outlined some of my thoughts on the matter, and which I'd like to read for you now. The digital TV conversion in the United States could well set the stage for a disaster and an opportunity. Some 50 million people in the United States still use over-the-air television, most of whom are poor, elderly, or don't speak English. Thus, broadcasters and the government are asking millions of people to make the leap to digital who can't afford it or who are unable to for one or a number of technical or logistical reasons. And where TV for many poorer communities still remains a key source of news and information, and actually another survey released just this week bears this out yet again, we could see many communities lose a source of information, widening the digital and informational divide in the United States, or worse. The two agencies in the U.S. government tasked with the conversion, the FCC and the NTIA, the Federal Communications Commission, and the National Telecommunications Information Administration, have no plan and no leadership to address the conversion. There's actually a government study that revealed this fact. Money is being spent, but per capita, compared with other digital conversion efforts internationally, the amount is laughable. The National Association of Broadcasters has promised some $700 million worth of TV time on public service announcements announcing the conversion and encouraging viewers to act, but that amounts to a one-time investment of 1% of the industry's annual profits, and since only 13% of public service announcements air in prime time and PSAs comprise just 0.5% of all TV airtime, the effort is, in a word, piddling. Plus, precious little action, comparatively speaking, beyond these token PSAs have been carried through. The lone major DTV conversion test held just last month in Wilmington, North Carolina, amounts to a false positive, since 92% of the community does not use over-the-air television in Wilmington and in the five-county area where the test took place. And Wilmington broadcasters left the analog signal for a month after the shutoff deadline. In fact, it's actually still on. The entire U.S. will be asked to go cold turkey, and a number of analysts and even FCC commissioners have termed the transition in stark terms: a train wreck, a fiasco, a tsunami, and as FCC Commissioner Michael Copps termed it before a congressional committee, the mother of all consumer backlashes. Whether or not this is all Chicken Little alarmism or a legitimate matter of historic proportions, we won't know until February, and maybe not even after that. But if we assume the latter, as evidence seems to suggest, there is also some very real potential here for some positive outcomes. On the media front, broadcasters and the very politics of media could face a degree of public scrutiny and a level of public interest perhaps unparalleled in American history. And that is no small matter. In 2003, in the wake of a controversial FCC media ownership rule rewrite, an unparalleled 3 million people responded to that rewrite, exceeding the previous high for responses to the FCC, which had previously been at 5,000. So you're going from 5,000 to 3 million in a fairly short amount of time. The scale of that response directly fueled political action that ultimately overturned the rewrite, and that overturn actually still stands. If the numbers and this assessment are anywhere close to accurate, we could see a scale of public response and perhaps outrage what could be 15 times larger than that of the uprising in 2003. Amid the public outrage that could well arise, a rare and extraordinary window of opportunity to improve policies that affect television and, by extension, all of American media is coming very soon, and concerned citizens and scholars would do well to prepare to seize the opportunity. A host of proposals for improving television and the media, which were long considered off the table, or at worst unthinkable, could well be brought into play. These proposals can include, but are no means exhausted to, the following. 1. Tax the commercial broadcasters by perhaps a fraction of a percent for use by the public, for use of the public airwaves. Idea number two. Tax the advertisers and marketers who air on TV by a fraction of a percent. Idea 3. Take the billions of dollars raised annually through those proposals. You would generate a huge amount of money, even by a fraction of a percentage of tax, into a public trust to help galvanize funding for networks of public service broadcasting and public service media in the United States. Idea 4, improve standards for license accountability, which could include revoking the licenses of one or more commercial broadcast stations or networks to reassign to public interest groups or broadcasters. That's not inconsiderable. In the entire more than 70 plus years of history in the United States, broadcasters have lost their licenses a grand total two times. One in Mississippi in the course of a racist broadcaster, famous WLBT case, where the station was actually lost its license after a legal struggle that took 7 years. And another broadcaster in Lansing, Michigan, which actually, technically speaking, lost its license, but actually still got to keep the station for reasons I won't go into here. Idea number 5, reassign the multitude of new digital TV channels that the commercial broadcasters are currently and plan to hoard to reassign to public interest groups or initiatives. Concerned scholars and activists have a role to play here. New ideas will go nowhere without the political muscle to make them real. And indeed, the DTV conversion and its political aftermath could help unite those disaffected by major commercial broadcasters, and those could include poor communities, communities of color, those who don't speak English, and the burgeoning media democracy movement, which has seen very substantial gains in recent years. They can all join in coalition efforts to win one or more changes, and I believe that scholars and activists should do a various number of tasks to assist in this and other efforts. What I've said is just but one perspective, and one, my answer, but not the only one, to the matter of the DT conversion at hand. And so I would like to extend to the panel here their perspective on this matter and the issues at play, and look forward to responding to them and hearing your thoughts as well. Thank you.
In this next excerpt, I respond to some of the points raised by the other panelists, and then begin a discussion with Bill Stotesbury, the GM and CEO of KLRU, the Austin, Texas PBS affiliate.
I have a couple of thoughts. Actually, I have a bunch of thoughts, but I'll limit it to about two or three. Brian? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had mentioned the point with regards to this 81-city tour that the FCC has actually been convening. There's something of an irony about this entire tour. Back in 2002 and 2003 with the FCC and their controversial media ownership rule provisions, they tried to basically ram that through, comparatively speaking, in the dead of night. Commissioners Michael Compson and Jonathan Adelstein had called for, let's have a tour, maybe like 12 cities across the United States. Mm-hmm. Officially, the FCC held just one tour, in the one city hearing, one in Richmond, Virginia, that was held in the run-up to that digital to that media ownership rule rewrite. And Michael Powell, son of Colin Powell, who was the chair of the FCC at the time, actually dismissed the idea with contempt. He actually was quoted as saying, there's no reason for the FCC to receive information from the public in this digital era of media and have to use a 19th century whistle-stop tour. Those were his words. And so yet, what are the FCC doing now with the digital conversion? A 19th century whistle-stop tour. and one that's not done very well. You're finding, however, instances like, for example, in San Francisco, where actually a lot of community organizers were able to hold press conferences and get an amazing amount of public response regarding this stuff. I'm also waiting for hearings on Atlanta, and they're coming to Chicago, where I live, November 20th. It's going to be like the second to last hearing there, and that's going to prove to be very interesting at the very least. So there's that great irony there that the FCC is doing what was decried just a few years ago and as its apparently main operational strategy with not much success. The phenomenon that Bill had talked about, or I think actually it was Bill there, had talked about regarding moving channels to the digital tier like public, like PBS, like C-SPAN, like public educational and government channels. That phenomenon actually has a name. It's called channel slamming. And that's basically where commercial broadcasters, be it mostly cable and also phone companies with their analog of cable, like AT&T and their new U-verse, are basically shoving any kind of non-commercial content to a what's being termed a digital ghetto. Basically on a single channel, usually in the digital tier, and usually without even the knowledge of broadcasters who are involved with these channels, when they discover it, they don't find out about it until it's already happened. And that's been something that people have been fighting around about around the country in this. So you're not alone on this.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, on this fight. I would disagree to some extent with regards to the point you raised regarding the concern that I think even after February 17th that things will be fine, especially where I think, and there's been evidence about this that's been bearing out, that increasingly what's now analog media and digital technologies are going to, over the next decade or so, basically smear into one and the same. There'll probably be some exceptions. I don't think radio is probably going to become digitized because experiments about that I don't think are bearing as much fruit as people had anticipated. But over time, and probably within a decade or so, what we perceive as media, broadcast, television among them, and what we perceive as the internet are probably going to be the same thing, effectively. And so I don't think that, and that's basically going to be connected with regards to the digital divide and digital access, where you're finding in the United States that that is leveling off. People who probably don't have internet access by now, for the most part, I don't think are going to get it. And so that means that I think that they're not going to be able to get the transmissions of that. This is something we could disagree with, but this is my reading of the situation, that I think that you could see perhaps maybe as much as a third of Americans not get media because they're not going to be on that side of the digital divide.
Disagree strongly.
What do you think?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is similar to models in the history of any diffusion of any technology, that, you know, there's a certain bell curve associated with it. And when we reach into the later adopter stages, sometimes technology gets adopted by fiat, if not by purpose. People will eventually replace televisions. Whether they replace them with a television or replace them with a different device remains to be seen, but the market is driving toward merged devices. And so, you know, every TV you buy is going to have the ability to draw in a signal from someplace at some point, whether it's a line signal or a wireless signal. And, you know, with the merger of your platform into multimedia platforms, at some point, it doesn't become unreasonable to expect that as people turn on their device, they'll receive a signal and they may not even know where the signal is coming from. That may not be a year from now, but it may be 5 years or 7 years from now. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, I think increasingly it becomes both a commercial necessity and a public good, a public necessity to provide ubiquitous wireless communication or ubiquitous communication.
Yeah, that I agree with.
And I think that as that occurs and communication essentially becomes free, and it becomes in the economic interest of manufacturers and content providers to assure that people have the opportunity to take advantage of that free backbone, that the final vestiges, you know, there's probably some asymptotic nature of right. The adoption curve, but I think it's not 33%. I think it's, you know, 3% or less as you move out toward the end who may or may not be be dragged kicking and screaming into that.
I think that the point you're raising here actually dovetails with the fight that I've been involved with regards to network neutrality and what basically amounts to internet freedom and access. Increasingly, internet access in the United States, unlike a lot of other developed countries and increasingly a lot of countries around the world worldwide, here it's seen as a commodity, less so as something like a public resource like water or electricity, where here everyone has it no matter where your standing in the society is, no matter what your income is. And worldwide, that's increasingly the case where the internet is being seen in that. Here, it's not, and it needs to be. And that's, I think, a policy fight that will probably prove well here, and which, frankly, I hope you're right. I don't think so, but that's, I think, where if we fight along those rights, those lines, that, you know, what I'm saying is chicken little alarmism will hopefully be just that. And, you know, this is one instance where I don't like to be wrong, but in this case, I hope I am.
You've been listening to excerpts of a presentation and discussion about the U.S. digital television transition held at the Flow TV Conference in Austin, Texas on Saturday, October 11, 2008. To learn more about Flow TV, go online to flowtv.org, spelled FLOWTV.ORG. On the matter of the digital television conversion, FCC Commissioner Deborah Taylor Tate will visit Chicago on Friday, November 21st to hold two town halls on the topic. One town hall will be from 9:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at the Northwest Copernicus Senior Center at 3160 North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago. The other town hall will be from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Black Box Theater at Kennedy King College, 740 West 63rd Street at the U Building between Halsted Street and Green Street. To learn more about these Chicago town halls and about the digital television conversion, go online to www.fcc.gov or www.dtvredalert.org.
Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.